Chapter 12. Lyria. Sling Blades. I flee the gunfire that killed my brother. My baby brother. Who I helped raise. Who I made a notch in the doorframe for every time he sprouted a bit taller. Used to joke he was a weed so tall his head would one day touch the sky. Now I leave him in the mud. Each heartbeat is a sledgehammer. Tears stream so thick I can barely see. Mud cakes my burning calves. The plastic homes flash past. There's more sounds now, more gunshots, and the warbling of energy weapons. They've come by land too. I hear the squealing of hover-track sleds. A fire started near the southern fence. I see four-wheeled land vehicles there and men with floodlights and torches. They carry guns and sling blades. Our lane is still quiet as I make it home. As if in denial about what the night brings, I burst in through the front door. My sister still sits at the table wearing her new shoes. What happened? Were those gunshots? It's the Red Hand, I say, just as the monsoon siren begins to wail from the antenna array behind our home. They didn't make a siren for the Red Hand. No, she whispers. Where is Tiran? He's... My throat constricts. Gone. Gone. She tilts her head as if she doesn't understand the word. What do you mean, gone? They shot him. What? I feel myself shuddering, losing control of my own body. They shot him. I'm sobbing. My chest heaves. I feel my sister's arms around me, holding me. He's dead. Tiran is dead. Not just dead. Mutilated. Get da, my older sister says, ghostly pale. She grips my head. Lyria, get da up. We have to go. Go where? I don't know, but we can't stay here. I nod, still dazed. She shakes me. Lyria, do it now. How can she be so calm? She didn't have to see Tiran's head dissolve into fragments. She pushes me towards the bunk room. I find Da awake and staring at me as if he already knows. Did he hear about Tiran? You know what's happening? I ask. He barely nods. I need you to help me with your arms. Tiran usually lifts him from his bed into his wheelchair. I'm not as strong. I slip my hands under my father's armpits. One, two, three. For the first time since Mum was buried in the deep tunnels, Da says something. No. It's more of a moan than a word. But it is unmistakable. His eyes are wide and emphatic, shakes his head and repeats it, no. His eyes glance down at his body, then shoot toward his chair. He's right. There's no way we'll escape the Red Hand with him on our backs, or that chair in the mud, not without Tiran. His milky eyes watch me. They see me now. That's what breaks my heart. He could have seen me sooner. He could have looked at me instead of draining his life away into the HC. Why now? Why even when we have so few seconds left? I wrap my arms around him. I kiss him on the forehead, staying there, smelling the musk of his skin and greasy hair, remembering what he was. With a heave, I hoist the old man from the bed toward his chair. I sag under his weight, nearly falling to the floor. The muscles of my lower back seize up, but I manage to twist my body and lever him into his chair. He lands roughly on his hip. More groans. Hold on, Da. We have to say goodbye. I push him into the front room where my sister and her children are readying to leave. Through the doorway, my sister has gathered her little ones. I need you all to hold hands, my sister is saying, and don't let go of each other no matter what. That's very important. Stay together. She looks at me. Lyria, Liam's still at the infirmary. Damn it. How could I forget him? Con starts crying. It's all right, love. It's all right, Ava says. Ella is silent and pinned tight to her breast, swaddled in blankets. My sister won't be able to make it to the centre of the camp and back, not with her children. I'll fetch Liam, I say. You make for the jungle. We'll meet you there. The jungle, she asks. You'll never find us in there. The East Guard Tower. There's trucks there, I say. The north looked quiet. Then meet us there at the north. Then we'll go together to the fishing boats. We can go downriver. A distant explosion rattles the plastic home. What about Da? She asks. He sits in his chair watching us impassively. I shake my head once. We can carry him, my sister says. But we both know we can't. We wouldn't make it 20 metres dragging him and the children. I look at the terrified children, then at my sister. Children, I say hollowly. Come kiss Dada for luck. Ava understands. Her calm cracks. In the tears, I see the scared little girl who wept in her bed when our mother passed. The one I'd have to sing to sleep even though she was older. I don't want to leave, Dada, Con cries. I'll bring him, I say. You all just have to go on ahead. Now kiss him. Believing me, the children rush to kiss my father on the cheek. His eyes brim with tears as they dart back and forth. My sister bends and kisses him on the brow. She stays there, trembling, before stumbling back. Con holds onto him, not letting go till his mother rips him violently away and moves them toward the door. The North Watchtower, she says. Be there soon. I will. Lyria.
Yes.
Bring me my boy. We hold each other's hands. A life full of wedding skirts, births, and love. Reduced now to a single second of fear. And then our hands are parting and the door closes and she's swallowed by the nightmare outside. Through a crack in the plastic I watch her run, clutching Ella to her breast and dragging her two boys along into the dark. I stay behind with my father in the hut, listening to the world ending beyond the thin walls. Some part of me thinks that if we stay here, the storm will pass us by. The plastic will somehow keep the Red Hand and their guns and sling blades out. I want to tell Da it will be well, that I'll see him soon. It's the most present he's been in a year. Looking at me, knowing this is the last time he'll see me. I kneel so that we are eye to eye and clutch his face in my hands. This is the man who tucked me in at night, who would sit me on his knee at Laureltide and tell stories of mining glories and pit vipers and fights. He was as vast as the sky itself. But now he is a broken man, watching helplessly as the world swallows his children. I will see you in the veil, I whisper to him, our foreheads together. I love you. I love you. I love you. Then I throw myself away from him. In three steps I am out the door. Leaving him behind is like tearing a part of my body away. My eyes sting with tears, but a cold clarity fills me. I have to get Liam. My sister is already gone. The camp's given over to madness. Gammas fleeing their houses, flames in the distance. Two ships roar overhead through the black sky, the rattling of automatic guns and the occasional whine of an energy weapon. Screams careen in from everywhere, swirling and swarming around me. I sprint diagonal between the homes, weaving my way through Gamma Township to the central infirmary. I collide with a man full on and spin down into the mud, taking his elbow to my face. It barely jars him. He stumbles back, carrying a child, then rushes on. I know him. Elro, one of my father's head talks from years back. He doesn't even look down at me. Struggling back to my feet, I find the infirmary with its door locked, a peaked white plastic building stained on its fringes by mud. Waiting there in the rain like a girl in a white dress. I hammer on the doors. Let me in! It's Lyria! Let me in! I kick the doors twice before they unlock from the inside and open. Three men and a woman stand in their yellow nursing livery, holding heavy medical instruments intended for my skull. I hold up my hands. Lyria! Janice, a yellow doctor and head of the infirmary, shouts. Let her through! Janice, where's Liam? In the back. Janice guides me through rows of cots filled with terrified children and infirm patients till we reach my nephew in the back. He's sitting in his bed with his hands wrapped around his legs, sightless and listening to the horror outside. What's going on out there? Janice asks. Red hand, I say. Drop ships and trucks. They're here? She asks. She can't believe it. But the Republic, damn the Republic, I say. We've got to run, Liam. I wrap my arms around the little boy. He's so thin he could be made of glass. His hair's an unruly explosion of red, like mine, but more closely cropped. And his mannerisms are all hesitant, like a boy asking a girl to dance at Laurel Tide. I kiss him on his head and wrap him snug in the little blue jumper I brought for him. I pull the hood up on his head so his little pale face is all that peeks out. It's well, it's well. I've got you. Where's Mum? He asks in a small voice. Waiting for us, but you have to come with me. Is she all right? He asks. I need you to be brave. Can you do that? Can you be like the goblin when he followed the reaper to the dragon maw? Can you do that for me? Yes, he says, nodding his little head. I can. I heft him from the bed and move to the door. Janice blocks my way. It'll be safer here, she says. It's a hospital. Even they have to respect that. I stare at her, dumbfounded. Are you bloody damn bent in the head? You need to get everyone and get out. Lyria! I don't stop to reason with her. I shoulder past and burst out of the infirmary, running with my nephew clutched to my chest. The gunshots are closer now. Rough voices yell to one another. A woman's screams are silenced with a wet thump. I weave through the gaps between the houses, heading for the north watchtower. Doors are broken off plastic hinges. Young men run about with arms full of food and tokens and HCs and a thousand things less precious than the life I carry. Liam's little pale arms cling around my neck. Someone screams, Gamma! And points at me. Terrified, I duck into an alley and lose them in the shadows. The guard tower is abandoned when we reach it. Its spotlight stares directly into the sky. The Republic soldiers who were there have fled. Somewhere a dog barks. My sister is nowhere to be seen. Ava! I call quietly, hoping she's in the shadows waiting for me. No one answers. Then men's voices come from between the houses behind me. They followed me into the alley. I rush through the gate. A muddy field stretches all the way to the dark jungle. We'll never make it. To the right is the camp's dump site, and beyond that, the river. Ava! I whisper again. The feet are closer. I pull Liam to the side and scramble into the shadows of the rubbish heap. I dive to the ground at the top of a mound and slide halfway down the other side. I tell Liam to be quiet and crawl a little back up the mound to look at the path I fled. A tide of gammas from my township rush through the gate toward the jungle. I know all of them. I don't see my sister among them, so I stay silent and hunker down in the shadow of the rubbish. But as the sounds of their footfalls fade into the night, a terrible fear of being left behind fills me. I'm about to rush from my place to join them when I see the glimmer of something near the tree line. I want to shout at my kinsmen, save them. But it's too late. The glimmer becomes 100, like the jungle itself is grinning and baring its pale teeth. My kinsmen scream as the men in the jungle come out to murder them in the dark with sling blades. I flee the screams, push deep into the dump site. Metal scratches my thigh as I run up a mound. I lose my balance and pitch sideways, tumbling down, crash hard into the refuse, barely shielding Liam. He's crying against my chest. The sweet scent of rot makes our eyes water. Something awful. A rat skitters across my arm. I push myself up and gain my feet, cradling my little nephew, legs stinging from the wound. Insects throb around my bare calves and thick clouds, biting and crawling. Heat from decomposition pulses up from the garbage. I find a hiding spot and huddle low underneath the remains of a broken industrial washer. Liam's shuddering in fear, small body racked by silent sobs. I set him down. My arms are numb from carrying him. Men rove near the path now, close to where we entered the dump. Their flashlights slash at the darkness. I flatten myself to the garbage and push a dirty finger to Liam's lips. A light beam goes overhead. The mosquitoes buzz around his face, casting shadows. I tighten his jumper so only his nose and mouth are showing out of the hood. Water from the rain slithers and drips through the garbage as the men speak to each other. The voices are like my father's, like my mother's, like my sister's and brother's. But now their tongues sound cruel, all hard and dark and sharp-edged. How can reds do this to their own kind? One comes close enough for me to see his painted hands. It's not paint that covers them, but blood, dried and cracking. The flashlights move on, men speaking amongst themselves. I'm left with fear. Where is my sister? Was she found? I pray she pressed on to the boats. I don't know what to do, where to go. So I hunch there and peer out at the dark shadows moving along the path. With the flashing of flames from inside the camp, I catch their faces. They're boys. Some no older than 14, with fledgling scraps of beard on chins, lean and gleaming with sweat. Shouting to each other, they peer into trash heaps, bent like hungry wild dogs. Liam's small hands clutch together. In permanent darkness, he can only hear the wounds these angry young men have carved into the night. He trembles. I brush rainwater from his face, wishing I had the power to take him from here to stop this. You're so brave, Liam, I whisper. Goblin brave you are. Where is Ma? We're going to meet her. She'll be at the boats, I reckon. Since you've been so brave, I've got something for you. I reach into my pocket and find the chocolate that I kept from dinner to give to him. I press it into his hand. Thank you, he says. As he eats, I hear whispers in the darkness near to us. I ease up and see several sets of eyes catching moonlight from beneath discarded water containers. A family in hiding. A little girl raises her hand to wave to me. I wave back. We're not alone. We can survive this. Somewhere out there, Ava is waiting for us. We'll go to her soon. I just need a breath. But then I smell the fire. Chapter 13, Lyria. First, the screams. It begins at the edge of the dump site near the watchtower, and soon spreads as more red hands light small blazes till a wall of fire rolls toward our hiding place. The air dances and writhes as tongues of smoke slither through the garbage, licking at my feet and legs. Liam screams in fear. I haul him up and clamber from our hiding spot. I run from the flames, but I'm hacking. Can barely breathe. Can't see, eyes streaming with tears. I stumble over mounds of garbage, legs sliced by metal and glass and feet sinking in mire up to the knee. Then faintly, I hear the voice of a young girl calling to me through the smoke. It drifts to me like nursery song, so small and gentle. And then I see her in the chaos of ash, waving her arm frantically for me to find my feet. I stumble up and follow her voice to find a seam in the smoke where I can gulp down clean air. There's others running ahead of us, 20, 40 manic souls stumbling through the garbage away from the flames, all bound for the river where the fishing boats are moored. I clear the smoke and heave for air on the edge of the dump site. Other refugees stream ahead of us through the brush going toward the boats. Cradling Liam, I join them and spare a look back. A pillar of smoke rises from the burning dump, a smear against the orange dawn. The sun rises over the camp that was once my home. Ahead, mothers run with children and tattered scarves flowing behind them. Young men stumble on, all earthly possessions left behind, carrying elders or wounded friends. It's not just Gamma, not just the Collaborator clan. I rush with the masses through the green underbrush toward the flowing river. Weeds slap my shins, mud clings to my feet. We're so near the river, almost free of the night. When I hear a scream ahead of us, then a second. In the muddy plain beyond the brush, a woman has fallen to her knees, her children behind her, her hands outstretched begging for mercy. The refugees have stopped, making a staggered line. I can't see past them. Before me, an old man falls to his haunches and sits in the mud, staring emptily ahead. In Logolos, when the head talks wanted to clear a tunnel of a pit viper infestation, they would light fires and force the pit vipers from their hiding places among the gears and nooks and crevices. Now we're the snakes. The red hand lit fires to force us from our refuge in the dump to bring us here. Barring our way to the boats is a staggered line of 20 young men covered with soot and sweat and carrying automatic weapons. Their hands are covered in red to the elbows. A lone woman stands with them, the same I saw kill Tyrion at the shuttle. Her rusty hair is streaked with white, half her face marred with terrible scars. The other half is worn beauty. She wears an armoured vest and carries a sling blade, brown with blood. She says something to a man who lifts his gun. Time is stuck with us in the mud. I push Liam behind me. There's a crack. Something hot and salty sprays my face. I wipe my eyes, hands coming away red. I see the old man sitting in the mud, wobbling now, his head strangely lopsided. His body shudders again. Only in the back of my mind do I realize metal is doing this to him. Another bullet rips through him and he pitches sideways, howling. The children shriek and try to run. Metal shreds them, kicking their heads back, contorting their bodies into a manic dance. I push Liam down. Something hot and hard punches me in the shoulder. I'm off my feet and sprawled in the mud. Cool veins of shock trickle through my arm as I suck mud through my nose. This is not real. This is happening to someone else. I roll onto my back. The sounds of the guns fade as I stare up at the blue sky. I'm rising into it like I did the first time I saw it with my own eyes. Up, up, toward a single silver teardrop, flying closer, closer. The teardrop glimmers hopefully. Is it the old man who watches the veil? Has he come to take me home to be with my father, my mother, Tirin? The teardrop divides, becoming three, or maybe it was always three, and maybe I'm not sinking into the sky. Maybe the sky is falling down on me. I hear in the distance the whisper of angry metal. It's a ship. Three ships. They leave vapor trails in the sky, one fat, two thin and quick. The Republic! Someone shouts a million kilometers away. The Republic! Heartbeat concussions ripple through the earth as missiles fall. Whoomp! 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 The fat ship litters the sky with little sparkling seeds. The seeds begin to fall, faster, faster, coming together like a flight of swallows, then splintering apart 1,000 meters above us. One roars straight toward me, a hot stream of metal and vapor. It slams into the mud, a demon of metal in the shape of a man. His armor is orange, his helmet shaped like the face of a snarling canine. He lifts his left fist and points it toward the raider firing line. Sound and fury erupt. Currents of distorted air shriek over the mud. Men run for cover or melt. Then he's gone, back into the sky, trailing a war howl through an electronic speaker. Telemannus! Lyria, Liam says, touching my leg. He follows it up till his hands find my face. He's alive, covered with mud, but alive. Lyria, are you hurt? He says through tears. I'm here, I say. I sit up and clutch him with my right hand. I'm here. I hold him and sob among the corpses. I'm here. Something is wrong with my left shoulder. It hurts more than anything has ever hurt. Blood leaks from it, and splintering pain threads its way down my throbbing arm. We're in a soup of broken, squirming bodies. The Red Hand are dead, or fled to cover to fire up at the sky. The two bone-white Republic ships fire at the hand trucks and landed transports. Steel men whip through the air. It's too much. Too loud. I take Liam away from it, following the few survivors of the massacre to hide amongst the reeds in the riverbed. There, hunkered in fear, we listen to the battle. A dozen others survived. They flinch when a bomb goes off. But I sit in silence, rocking back and forth, watching bugs go out over the water. My sister is safe. Her children are safe. We'll see them soon and share a smile. Liam and I will be with them soon. Look, someone beside me shouts, pointing up. The knight with the canine helmet plummets from the sky, trailing smoke. He lands with a splash in the river 30 meters from us. We all watch the water. He does not re-emerge. I look around at the survivors. Not one moves. He's going to drown. We gotta help him, I murmur through chattering teeth. Cold despite the heat. No one looks my way. I say it louder. We gotta help him. Still no one moves. You gutless slags. I tell Liam to stay put, and I stumble to the water, wading out into it until it's at my neck. Deeper than I thought. I won't be able to lift him by myself. I curse and look around, spotting a long length of rope tethering a half dozen of the fishing boats together. I wade back to the boats and unravel the rope, then press back into the depths as the boats drift apart. The current tugs at my waist like a bad dancing partner, threatening to pull me downriver. Soon the water's over my head. I dive down, looking through the murk for the fallen knight. I can't see him. The silt is so thick I have to surface twice before I find him by luck, when my right foot kicks a piece of metal. I trace my feet over the armour, barely able to find the outline of the man. I tie the rope around his leg as best I can with my wrecked shoulder and kick my way back to the surface, trailing the rope behind. When I make it back to the shore, a group of Reds wait to help me, all brave and heroic after I do all the bloody work. 10 sets of hands tug on the rope till, with a great heave, we manage to drag the knight free of the water and into the shallows. We hunch over him in the mud. The orange armour is filthy and charred at the abdomen from where something hit him in the air. He's a giant. Biggest bastard I've ever seen. His helmet alone is nearly as large as my torso. The great gauntlets of the armour could squash my head like a pit viper egg. Water pulses out of the holes in the metal. I run my fingers over it, expecting it to be hot for some reason. It's cold and faintly iridescent. "Look at the size of him," someone gasps. "Has to be a bloody damn obsidian." "No, they fear white feathers. Is he dead? Blast hit his generator," an old man says. I think his name is Almore. He was a drill boy for Delta years ago. He kneels in the mud beside the knight, running his hands over the metal. "Pulse shield is off, but means he got no oxygen down there. Could be drowned." "We got to get him out," I say. "Anyone know how this shit works?" a woman asks, pulling on the helmet. It doesn't budge. "Should be an emergency release or some such," Almore says. He fumbles at the jawline. "Here!" With a hiss, the faceplate pops loose. Water pours out. The old man pushes the faceplate back till it bends into itself, revealing the knight's face. He's no obsidian, but he looks carved from granite. A red beard covers his heavy jaw. His head is bald and titanic, and a slim scar stretches down his right cheekbone. His nose is smashed flat, and his eyes are small and ringed with delicate eyelashes. He's a ghoul. The first I've ever seen with my own eyes, the first any of us have ever seen. "Is he breathing?" Almer asks. No one moves toward the knight. Still gutless. I lean over the man and put my ear to his nose. Just then, he spasms. I lurch back in terror as he vomits water. As he hacks, I sink back into the mud. Bone tired. Overhead, the sky is torn to shreds as more supersonic ships come from the sky and descend to save the camp. The Red Hand will retreat, but Camp 121 is burning.
Chapter 14. Ephraim. Anniversary. In a small corner booth, in a shady back room of a cesspit, two slags are slouched, drinking out of dirty glasses like pervy old gargoyles. They look up as I make my way through the neon green demon dust smoke that wafts from the burners of two red mechanics. South of Hyperion city centre, 160 clicks from the maple-lined boulevards of the promenade, towers the brutalist Atlas interplanetary docks. There are 7 main towers to the aid, each inhuman in its size. Atlas sees 1 billion travellers pass through his halls every Earth standard year. But for every new oligarch and old blood gold that lands here, there's a flood of space mariners and interplanetary immigrants and passengers. All these weary travellers crave restaurants, casinos, hotels, and whorehouses before taking transit to whatever their final destination on Luna might be. It's a tumour that won't stop growing. That's why it's called the Mass. Behind me, through the open doorway, electric signs and high-resolution digital flesh fishhook the eyes, pulling travellers from their trams or private air cars, jerking them headlong into the vestibules of commerce to pump blood and cash into the veins of this hinterland city. It's a sort of place you go to forget about your life. But, in the irony to end all ironies, it's where mine began. The bar looked different back then. I was 2 years out of the Legion, and I'd come to the Mass to burn a few credits with some squaddies from Piraeus. 2 drinks in, some idiot spilled a glass of spiked milk down the back of my neck. I swung around to teach the prick some manners. But one look at that goofy face and baggy suit, I started laughing so hard I couldn't raise a fist. The man stared back at me with a milk moustache and wide, apologetic eyes. Who the hell orders milk in a place like this? The man was young, simple, and 2 years into the Legion from some earth backwater. We sat and talked in that corner booth and closed the place down. Rest was history. He was my refuge. My small town boy with a big heart and a bigger laugh. Jove knows what he saw in me. "I beg your pardon," I say to the slags in the corner booth. They eye my rumpled suit, wondering if I'm lost. "What do you want?" the brown one asks. He's a Terran bastard by the look of his thick thighs, his loamy eyes narrow. "I reserve this booth, citizen," I say. "Dey don't take reservations here. Slag off." "Sit there," says a larger man, a grey with a sour look, "and shut it, before you get carved up." He points to a nearby open table and flashes a curved iron knife the size of my forearm. It shimmers blue as he activates its charge. "And you're gonna do the carving?" I ask wryly. "You don't look like you can even stand." He stands. "Please, bitch. I used to own little slits like you in Whitehold," the grey says. By the look of his knotted forearms, he could easily break me into kindling. I should just move on. "Whitehold?" I scoff. "That's odd. I thought they sent pig sodomizers to Deep Grave." Both stand, blades shimmering in the low light. I stumble backward, too late in realizing my tongue's drunker than the rest of me. The grey's about to come and try to open me up with that cutter of his when he sees something behind me and stops dead. There's silence in the bar. Something fiendishly unique has just walked through the door behind me. And anything unique enough to this sort of crowd could only mean one thing. She came, after all. I turned to see a grey woman my height, but built like a snub-nosed boxer with the physical dimensions of a concrete building block. Freckles made dark by her time under the harsh Mercurian sun, mole an ugly, broad nose, while her hair, shaved on the sides of the head, shoots up from the top of her head like a surfacing great white. Her military uniform is all black, but every eye, wary bartender to dazed whore, scans the red flying horse standard on the forearms of her jacket and the matted wolf cloak that hangs from her left shoulder. Pegasus Legion, Howler Battalion, one of the Reaper's own. The woman strides past me up to the men blocking our path to the booth. "Move." They dip their heads politely and back away. She sits down and pours 2 shots of what remains of their whiskey into the glasses, wipes 1 glass for herself and nods to me. I join her as she tosses them a gold Octavia, 100-credit loon crescent. Still the currency of the day, despite the rising sad attempts to mint new legal tender. For the whiskey, citizens. They skulk away, and conversations slowly start again throughout the bar. The woman looks back to me, flinty eyes searching. Holiday T. Nakamura, the howler, in the leathery flesh, I say. Ephraim T. Horn, the dumbass with a death wish. She jerks her head at the two thugs. What's your damage? The usual. Would you like a thank you for saving my ass? Don't thank me yet. Night's young. Besides, the obsidian with the railgun over there might be a bit too much for you to chew. Huh? Far side, second booth. Big girl with a bulge under the armpit. She jerks her head to a shadowy booth where a large shape is hunched in the shadows over a drink with an umbrella in it. In the haze from the vodka and pills, I didn't even notice her there. You're slipping, F, Holiday says, and she warily sniffs the whiskey bottle. Damn it, I sigh. I'll be right back. Do you need help? Only if you have tickets to the zoo. What? Don't ask. I stalk across the bar. Volga hunches sheepishly as if she can sink into the shadow of the booth so I won't see her. She gives up when I snap my fingers at her. Outside. Rain drips sluggishly down from the green awning over the bar's entrance. The bar itself is in a block of restaurants and drinking halls, directly abutting a multi-level thoroughfare. Past the small retaining wall is a precipitous drop down into the concrete canyon between the buildings. I push Volga in the chest. You stalking me now?
No.
Volga?
Yes, she admits. I am worried about you.
Worried about me? You're the one who can barely catch a cab without me.
I tracked you, did I not?
So I taught you something at least, but not how to mind your own business, you dumb giant.
You seem sad. Not your problem.
You got enough of those. Don't make me one of them.
But we are friends. Friends look out for each other.
She nods inside.
Who is that?
Her cloak? That's none of your damn business. But we're not friends, Volga.
I push a finger in her chest and stare up at her bluff face.
We work together, business associates. That is the totality of our relationship. She stands there as if I've struck her. I sigh in annoyance. Go home and stop following me just because you don't have your own life. I don't have to tell her twice. She hunches her shoulders against the rain and disappears up a flight of stairs to the taxi level above. I head back inside, where Holiday has made some progress on the bottle, but her chair is shifted, like she's just gotten out of it. Did she listen at the door?
You know her?
She asks.
No, I snap.
Right. Well, good to see F. She traces the rim of her glass with a calloused finger. To be honest, I'm surprised you came. Ouch. Thought I wouldn't care anymore. Thought you wouldn't remember Trigg's birthday. And I thought your messiah master wouldn't let you off the leash for some R&R. Don't you have a parade to attend? That was yesterday, but you knew that. I shrug. Well, this place has gone to shit.
Yep.
I prefer the tiki torches to whatever this is. She trails off and gestures to the green lighting and myriad lowlifes. I snort. Maybe we're just getting too cultured. Still, has to be better than the Mercury sandbelt.
Hell, yeah it is,
she says heavily. She's never been a looker, but the latest tour has been hard on her. Still, most of the wear seems on the inside. She sits at the table with the weight of the planet pressing her down into the whiskey bottle.
You fall in the rain? I ask. She nods.
Saw the newsreels. Looked like a shit show.
What's one of those like? A rain.
She shrugs. Good for weapons contractors. Hostile to the human experience for everyone else. To the returning hero and her perspicacity, I raise my glass. She tips her glass to me, to the malignant underachiever. We click our glasses together and down the liquor. It's cheap enough. I can taste the plastic of the bottle it came in. Ration fare. My glass is refilled before it reaches the table. We do another. More after that. Drinking till it's murdered proper. Holiday examines the remnants of her last glass, wondering how it came so soon. She reminds me of all soldiers who've come home from the war. Worlds unto themselves, tense, eyes constantly assessing. She awkwardly tries to make conversation because she knows she's supposed to. So, what's new? You still contracting? You know me, kite in the wind. I swish and swoosh my finger through the air. Which corp?
You wouldn't know him. She doesn't smile. I wonder if it hurts her to see me as much as it hurts me to see her. I was afraid of this, of coming here, sliding back into it all.
So, you're living good and easy.
Only thing easy is entropy. That's funny. It's not mine. I shrug. I stay busy.
There are other ways to stay busy. Meaningful ways.
Tried that. My hand instinctively drifts to my chest where the scars from the gold are hidden under my suit jacket. I noticed her watching my hand. I drop it. Didn't take. Her datapad buzzes on her arm. On call? I ask. She silences it without looking down.
Grand Theft's gone up. They've got a task force now. The Sovereign is tired of the city's culture being plundered for the highest bidder.
The Sovereign, eh? How's old Lionheart? Still giving out amnesty passes to murderers and slavers?
That's still under your skin?
Grays, short in life, long in memory. Forget that little jingle. Tell me, does the new task force have a pretty insignia? I bet they do. Maybe a flying tiger or a lion with a sword in its lustrous mouth.
You were the one who chose to leave the Rising F.
You know why I left.
If you didn't like how things were going, you could have stuck around, made a difference. But I guess it's easier sitting in the cheap seats throwing bottles.
Make a difference? I smile nastily. You know, when the Hyperion trials started, I thought there'd finally be some justice. Honest to Jove, I thought the gold would finally pay the bill, even after Endymion, even after what they did to my boys. I touch my chest again. But then your Sovereign got cold feet. Sure, some society military brass, some high-up psychos from the Board of Quality Control got life in deep grave. But more got full pardons, because she needed their men, their money, their ships. So much for justice. Holiday holds my gaze, willful. After Trigg died on that Martian peak, I joined the Rising. More for revenge than anything else. I wasn't a believer. Eventually they put my Parius and Legion-honed skills and understanding of gold culture to use, hunting peerless war criminals down. Used to call ourselves Scar Hunters. Just another slick name. I know I shouldn't press the politics with her. She's as thick in the head and set in her ways as ever. Just another grunt, seduced by the pretty demigods. But the booze is making me care. You know, every time I saw a gold slaver walk free for the sake of the war effort, it was like watching them spit on Trigg's grave. Aja might be dust, but men and women
just like that bitch warped the worlds because the people holding your leash couldn't follow through. Should have put a Grey as sovereign. At least we finish shit. I drain my glass for emphasis and feel like an idiot talking head on an HC show. Cute, empty words and flashy maxims. You know, I can't help you if you're caught on the job, she says. And like that, I'm dismissed because she's always right, and I'm always just running my mouth. Public urination is a victimless crime, I say with a smile. I pull out a burner and light it. I meant what I said last time. About the Hyperion Chimera match, I'd have lost a fortune on that bet. Embarrassing spectacle, but faux war is unpredictable, ne? Karachi is a safer bet. The offer is still on the table, F. We could use a man like you. Come back. Help us unwind the syndicate. You can save lives. I am saving a life. Mine. By staying as far away from your masters as humanly possible. Shame Trig didn't get the same chance. She watches me through the smoke I blow in her face. I don't want to do this anymore. Be more specific. This. She looks around the bar. This isn't for him. It's not even for me. It's for you. So you can sink in it and let it rot you. That's not what he would have wanted. What would he have wanted? For you to have a life, a purpose. I roll my eyes. Why'd you bother to come? I didn't make you. Because my brother loved you, she says sharply. She lowers her voice. He would have wanted more for you than this. Then maybe you shouldn't have gotten him killed. The old holiday wouldn't hit me. It's been 10 years, asshole. You have to let him go, or it's gonna eat you up. I shrug. What's left to eat? I didn't deserve her brother's love, and I'm sure as shit don't need her pity. I flag down the bartender, and he comes over with another bottle. Holiday shakes her head as I pour myself a glass. I'm not coming back here next year. So sorry. We'll miss you. Break the chains and all that. She stands and stares down at me, about to say something spiteful, but she swallows it down, enraging me because I can smell the pity. You know what just rubs me raw, I say up to her. You look down at me because you're in that little uniform and you think me cheap. But you're the one too stupid to realize you're wearing a collar. You're the one he'd be ashamed of. The only good thing about him being dead is that he doesn't have to see you like this. So long, F. At the door, she glances back down at her data pad, and a shadow of fear passes over her face from what she sees there. Then she's gone into the rain. 2 glasses later, I abandon the bottle and stumble out of the bar and onto the sidewalk. Rain drips its way through the labyrinth of city above and below, growing fouler by the level. I go to the edge of the sidewalk and peer over the rusted metal rail down into the airway thoroughfare. It's a 1,000-meter drop to the masses' fetid ground level. Flying cars and taxis blink through the gathering fog. From the size of hulking buildings, advertisements seep miasma stains of neon greens and violent reds into the air like rainbow pus. On a digital billboard, a 6-story red child is wandering alone in the desert, lips cracked, skin burnt absurdly. His foot strikes something in the sand, and eagerly he begins to dig, and lo, he discovers something buried, a bottle. Feverishly, he twists off the top and takes a drink. He laughs with delight and holds the glistening bottle up to the sun, where it sparkles and beads with divine drops of perspiration. The word ambrosia sparkles onto the screen, a little wing-heel logo in the corner. A distant roar comes from the sky as a large passenger ship leaves its berth at aid, aimed at the invisible stars. I drink from my bottle, wishing I'd never left Hyperion for the mass, wishing I'd gone to a pearl club and found a pink to swallow my attention. Holiday was right about one thing. This just picks at the wound. But if I don't pick, then it feels like it didn't matter. And if it didn't matter, then neither do I. I pull my datapad out with one hand, almost dropping it over the rail, and pull up the last video played. Security cam footage. A wintry landscape fills the air in front of me. Careless raindrops punch through the hollow. Trig is stranded on the bridge to a landing pad that juts out from a mountainside, like a waiter's arm bringing a tray. A huge gold in blue armour charges him as he runs back to the Reaper. She plunges her blade through his spine, out his stomach, and hoists him in the air like a street vendor's kebab. Then she hurls him off the side of the bridge. My love spatters against the rocks beneath. His blood darkens the white snow. I hurl the datapad down into the abyss, tears and rain blurring my vision. The railing is slippery against my hands as I find myself climbing it. Standing on the edge, looking at the cars beneath and the darkness beyond them, I feel the pain just as sharply as I did 10 years ago when Holiday called me. I was in the Piraeus insurance offices. Didn't even make a sound when I hung up. I just took off my uniform, ditched my badge and left that office for the last time. I could leave that quietly now. But as I lean forward to go over the edge, something stops me. A hand gripping the back of my jacket. I feel my feet slide out from under me as I'm jerked off the rail back onto the sidewalk. I land hard on the wet concrete, the air rushing out of me. 3 pale-faced men in black leather dusters and chrome glasses stare down at me. Who the fuck? A fist the size of a small dog sends me to darkness.
Chapter 15. Lysander. From the Depths. In the cockpit, Pytha has gone silent, now locked into the ship's battlesink. Her eyes stare distantly as her mind and the ship's computer function as one. Better start thinking about how you want to die, Cassius says to me as I slide into the observation seat behind Pytha's. One engine's down thanks to you playing Lorne. This is worse than the astral dump in Lorio. Nothing's worse than that. I look at the sensor displays and the data readouts. Never mind. We're being pursued by the 3 craft. Not slapped together pirate ships, but military vessels. Doesn't matter that they're old. Their engines seem to be in prime shape. Pytha's returning mid-range fire with our own railguns. Can't see the drama of it. It's all displays and sensor readouts in here. I feel the familiar shudder in the ship as her munitions funnel out of their magazines into the magnetic firing rods and race across space toward our pursuers. How many more shots do we run dry? Can we lose them in the asteroid field, I ask? Not dense enough, Cassius says. Can we set down? They're too close. Can we? No, he says. Can't hide, can't run, can't fight, damn it! He slams his hand on the console. You should have listened to me! I'm sorry, Cassius. Don't use my name. We have guests on board. She's unconscious. That crew isn't. You want one of them trying to collect a core bounty while we're dodging Askamani? He shakes his head, marvelling at my stupidity. I wasn't going to stand by and let those savages eat one of us. One of us? My grandfather would have tried to save her. Course he would have. He'd have gutted 100 low colours to save 1 gold life. Today, you killed how many? 12? I see their mouths frothing in fear, their eyes wide like a dying horse's, all white. Was it worth it? You could have helped them, he says sorrowfully. But you went for her, one person. I take the punishment. It's earned. but he'll forget today. It'll be diluted by time. For me, I know it will not. My memory will trap me with those screaming faces even as I lie on my deathbed. I will see their cracking nails against the mesh, smell the urine on the deck, and I'll wonder how many I could have saved if I'd had more sense. Our ship shudders again as another projectile hits us. Our kinetic shields send it ricocheting off into space. If they were aiming to kill, they'd use missiles, but they're aiming for our engines. They want us alive, I say. Of course they do. They saw that we're gold. They'll rape us and kill us when they get bored of it. And they'll eat us, I say. These ones are cannibals. He catches the fear in my voice. How long can the engines last if we overburn? I ask, knowing the answer, but knowing too where I need to push him. He glances down at Pytha. Not long, maybe an hour, two. Then we're dead metal. But where would we go? Nearest asteroid city is 5 days out. The Rim? The Rim, he says. You forget your last name? My last name? He lowers his voice, looking back down the hall. Your grandmother ordered the destruction of one of their moons and their docks. So they say. They think I personally stomped in the head of Rebus Ar-Ra. The Askamani won't follow if we make the line. They fear the Rim more than we do. There's a reason for that. The chance they'll have a warship even 6 days away from where we enter is negligible. Our ship shudders again. Pytha jerks in her seat. Blood dribbles down her lips. She's bitten her tongue. Her mouth guard wobbles on the console. I pry open her teeth and push the thin slip of plastic in. I made a mistake in there. But this is a matter of probability. We can slip over the line, shed the Askamani, fix our engines, then... No ship has crossed into Rim space in 10 years. I won't risk starting a war. Then what's your plan, I ask? We turn around and fight. We can get inside one of their ships, turn the guns on the other corvettes. I've seen men do it. Fight. Of course that's his answer. We're not those men, I say. His warrior vanity looks wounded. And we don't have a launch tube on the rear of the ship. We'd have to pivot the ship starboard. And then we'd fire back into a fusillade of railgun fire. And if we make it through that, adding their current velocity to the velocity of the Spitz tube, we will hit their viewports with... I pull from my memory the detailed report and analysis my grandmother had me make on Darrow's mathematically suicidal assault on the Vanguard. Potentially 9 times the velocity used to breach the Vanguard. Our bones will be indistinguishable from our urine. Really? Care to wager? Shit. What about S-1392? The asteroid? It's the one the gold bought passage to. I reference the sensors. It's 2 hours away, 3 hours closer than the line. Before she fell unconscious, the girl said that help was there. His eyes narrow. When exactly did you have time to have a conversation with her? In the medical bay. We don't know who she is. We don't know where she's from. Do you even know what kind of help she meant? No, I confess. But opportunities multiply as they are seized. Don't quote Sun Tzu at me like it was your idea. Her help could be anyone. It could be the gory damn Ash Lord himself. That would be a boon for us. For you, maybe. Your godfather would skin me alive. He stares at the obsidian chips on the sensors. She used your razor. Did she have a scar? If I say yes, he won't go to S-1392. He'll try to fight. No. No scar, I say. Then I feel the guilt building. My brain has always been faster than my conscience. Our ship shudders again, harder this time, and the displays show damage to our starboard thrusters. Cassius winces with each shudder of the hull. It wounds him to see the Archimedes bleed. Slag it, he grips Pytha's shoulder. Pytha, set course for asteroid S-1392. Increase engine output to 15% over the red line. I don't care if they melt together. In her sink, she does not respond, but the ship does. I sit down as the Archimedes rumbles around us. The gravity pulls on my body as the compensators strain at the sudden acceleration, and the Archimedes races for the asteroid. The obsidians fall behind our sudden acceleration, but slowly they begin to match. The die is cast. While Cassius prepares the ship for potential boarders by outfitting the rescued crew with weapons, I return to the medbay to check on the girl to see if I can draw any more information from her. She's unconscious still. I watch her for a moment, feeling more protective than I should for a stranger. Tenderly, I cut the rest of her clothing away and begin to clean the oil from her skin with alcohol scrubs. I drape a medical blanket over her to protect her decency. When I look up, her eyes are open and seem to have been watching me for some time. I feel colour rising in my cheeks, fearing that she'll think I was doing something untoward. But her gaze is softer now than at our first meeting, less animalistic. She looks at the razor on my hip. "We're bound for the asteroid," I say gently. "You said there was help there. What sort of help?" She tries to speak, but her words are too weak to come out. "Salve," I say, looking at the new layer of res flesh I used to cover her scar. "Save your strength." I set a hand on her shoulder. "I should check your wound, may I?" She makes a small nod with her head. I pull the blanket to the side and examine the angry flesh. My cauterization was sloppy. I find a fresh bandage inside the cabinet and return to her wound. She flinches as I apply disinfectant cream. To soothe her, I recite one of my favorite verses from my mother's library. "As from the darkening gloom a silver dove upsoars and darts into the eastern light, on pinions that naught moves but pure delight, so fled thy soul into the realms above, regions of peace and everlasting love." The girl's fallen unconscious again by the time I finish the verse, and this time I let her alone. All those lives for her. As I leave, I smudge oil on her face to help mask the res flesh covering her scar and hope that I've not lied to Cassius in vain. At full burn, we manage to close the distance to the asteroid in under 2 hours. The cabin is now bathed crimson by the warning lights as our last engine overheats. Our inertia carries us forward, but the Askamani are closing, eating up the distance between our ships. Soon they'll reel us in with magnetic tow beams and burn through our hull. We sit in silence. Pythas unsynced with the ship now. Our guns are twisted scrap. Our shields are gone. The whole ship vibrates as the largest of the Askamani craft locks onto our hull with a tow beam, slowing our velocity. Cassius unfurls his razor and I cradle mine. My hand is sweaty. My chest is tight and my mouth chalky and dry. I sit with my legs crossed on the floor in silent meditation, letting the fear flow into me so I can be its master when its authors burn through our hull and enter our halls. Cassius turns to me as he tightens the screws on the gauntlets of his pulse armor. We've both discarded our clunky Evo suits for pulse armor breastplates and arm gear. We meet them at the door. "I want you to stay behind me. There's not enough room in the corridors for us to fight side by side. If I fall, make sure they do not take you alive." He looks to Pytha. "I mean this since..." His sentence drifts without finishing. I follow his eyes to the rad sensor display. It warps sideways. The display's pixels disintegrate into a dancing pattern of blue and black static. Pytha squints. "Someone's jabbing the nav." "Can't be the Askamani," I say. "They don't have tech enough to compromise our instruments." "Who, then?" Pytha asks. "Oh, hell," Cassius murmurs. "Oh, gory hell!" I follow his eyes out the viewport to the large, seemingly benign asteroid in the distance. S-1392. Pytha enlarges the visual display. Shadows cloak half the asteroid. The surface is dirty pearl white and riven with impact craters. The shadows stir. Something moves in the dark distance, streaking out from the bowels of the asteroid. It comes into space like a black eel squirming its way from the recesses of a dark sea cavern, flowing out of shadow, eyes glinting with pearly menace. But this eel is not made of flesh and blood. It is made of metal, painted black, and marked with a three-headed electric dragon on its sides. It is a warship. In this empty expanse where no warship has flown for more than a decade, a first-rate destroyer races toward us. 1.3 kilometers long, brimming with weapons and high-grade shielding, and flanking it are two torch ships of an unfamiliar design. From their hangars depart three squadrons of strange fighter ships that look like deep-sea horrors. They close the distance in half a minute and speed silently past us to shred the Askamani ships without even the formality of a radio broadcast. The fighter squadrons deliver elegant death as they lace the Askamani with railgun fire and spit off missiles that crackle silently over the blast-scored hulls of the raiders till each vessel vents oxygen and shivers apart to float dead and quiet into forever space. The engagement lasts less than a minute. Debris pings against our hull. Pytha's voice trembles. "What was that?" A blinking red light on the comm signals an incoming direct transmission from the destroyer itself. It lurks in the distance, not approaching us. Beside me, I sense Cassius's unease. "What kind of ship is that?" Pytha asks. "Lysander?" I stare out the viewport. "I don't know. But Cassius knows, and there's a feeling about him like he expected this, like this was some inevitable end. I'm beginning to understand. You lied to me, he says. He looks over to me with heartbreak on his face. She had a scar, didn't she? I accept his anger and meet his eyes. She did. He thinks I have killed us, and maybe I have, but as long as we breathe, there will be more opportunities for escape. We've jumped from the fire into the frying pan. Open the transmission, he says. Static crackles through the open channel until a cold voice calls out from the deep in an accent not heard on the streets of Mars or the halls of the Luna since the Rim closed its borders a decade ago. The long, lazy vowels that linger in the back of the throat hail from the volcano moon of Jupiter, the same moon that House Ra, leaders of the Rim, call home. It is the accent of Io and the Lords of the Dust. Attention, Archimedes, the disembodied voice says. This is the Rim Dominion destroyer, Charybdis. Your communications equipment is neutralized. Any deviation from present course will result in the destruction of your vessel. Any resistance will result in the destruction of your vessel. Stand by for boarding. The comm goes off. Silence sits with us in the cockpit. Desperate, Cassius grabs the comm. Charybdis, we are not in violation of Rim space. Repeat, we are in neutral territory. This is a violation of the Pax Ilium. Repeat, we are not in Rim space. No response. Cassius hurls the comm in anger. Pytha flinches as the plastic shatters against the metal bulkhead. Better our own kind than Askamani, I say, though I'm disquieted by the fear I see in his eyes and Pytha's. We can reason with them. Reason? Bring me the fascium, Pytha. I look at him and wonder if his fear is warranted. Lysander, get my box and yours and put it in the vault. He pulls his House Bellona ring from the chain around his neck and pushes it into my hand. Make sure there's nothing that could lead them back to who we are. Hollows, weapons, rings, everything goes in the vault. And Carnus's razor. That cover you have on it won't fool them. Hide it or we're dead. I rush through the halls to the living quarters where I collect Cassius's oak box in which he keeps his family heirlooms, the meagre remaining inheritance of a man who once could have ruled Mars. I fetch my own box, a large ivory vessel that carries the last relics of my past. I deposit both boxes in the hidden vault in the wall behind the ship's oven. I frisk my body to make sure I've not forgotten anything. Grudgingly, I take my grandmother's ring that hangs around my neck and Carnus's razor and push them into the box. By the time I've returned to the cockpit, Cassius has opened the fascium, which we've bought in a black market on Ceres. Set in foam is a honeycombed thin grey mask, a vial of smelling salts, a chemical ice pack, and a missing holster for the pain-killing stim syringe, which we emptied weeks ago to fill our field kits. You don't happen to have any extra stims, he asks me. I use them on the gold, don't you? He shakes his head. Gave them all to the prisoners. Gory hell, I mutter, looking at the mask's honeycombs. Cassius. He laughs and lets a bit of his old roguish smile break through. It's fine, my good man. Pain's just a memory. Are you space mad? Pytha asks flatly. You can't use that monster without stims. I can check the hold, I say. We might have missed a pack. Cassius shakes his head. No time. Pytha's horrified. Lysander, don't let him. I meet Cassius's gaze. I'll hold you down. Cassius glances down into the mask, a distant, forlorn look in his eyes. The same look he had when we had to pay for engine parts by collecting a bounty on a former gold tribune. It asks how it came to this, so far from what he thought it would be. Sparing a gentle smile to us, one that belongs to another time, a gentler version of himself, he brings the mask to his face till only his eyes are visible. He tightens the plastic latch at the back so it is secure to his head. Don't let me take it off, he says. Coral hold, I ask? Mantis lock. I'll break your arms in a coral hold. I obey. Sitting behind him, I wrap my legs around his midsection and loop my arms around his biceps, then under his armpits, and clasp my hands together at the middle of his spine. Pytha, you flip the switch. She creeps forward. Muttering to herself, he grips the activation knob on the side of the mask. On you. Do it. Pytha twists the activation knob on the mask. There's a sibilant hiss as the 300 needles built into the plastic of the scrambler mask spring forward into the skin, bone and cartilage of Cassius's face. He jerks once, twice, and then a gurgling scream escapes from beneath the mask like seething steam from a kettle. His muscles knot and clench rock hard as he thrashes back into me, twisting so viciously with his arms that I think my own will break. He screams, babbling incomprehensible curses as he rolls, kicking out and almost catching Pytha in the shin. She jumps back. The mask mercilessly pumps artificial filler into his face, grafting imitation bone onto his jaw and forehead and eye sockets. In 20 seconds, the mask's indicator blinks from red to yellow, and the worst of Cassius's convulsions begin to fade. We're on our sides, breathing heavily. He mules and drifts into shallow insentience. The indicator blinks green. I disentangle myself from his arms. There's a stabbing line of pain down my forearm that insinuates a stress fracture. Pytha rushes to Cassius and gingerly unlatches the mask. His face is a bubbling mass of angry, swollen flesh, like a wax figure strayed too close to flame. Bit by bit, the swelling subsides under the anti-inflammation pack that Pytha applies. When she pulls the pack away, our handsome friend is gone, replaced by a thuggish visage with a primitive forehead, a bulbous, veiny nose, chipped ears, and a slack mouth with engorged, lazy lips. The peerless scar is gone, recessed into this new, bronzy's visage. Pytha wipes tears from her eyes. She looks up at me in recrimination and jerks the smelling salts out of my hands to crack them under his nose. "You're prime, Dominus," she says to him, cradling his head and wiping the vomit from his face as he comes to. "Easy as sin. It's all over now, it's all over." He sits up with her help, and together we watch out the viewport to see the destroyer opening its docking bay to swallow us whole.